Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm David Baddiel.
And I'm Saida Farsi. And this is A Muslim and a Jew Go There.
And on the agenda this week, we've got ongoing rows about Eurovision and Israel's inclusion in it, pink washing, the whole idea of that, and BDS. What is it and why is there a bill against it that the government are trying to push through?
And if that isn't controversial enough, we are going to go there today by talking about the Taliban and their disturbing recent announcement that they're going to resume publicly stoning for adultery.
But before we get there, Eurovision, which for anyone listening outside of Europe, we do have some listeners outside of Europe, is a song contest, happens every year in Europe. It's organised by the European Broadcasting Union, and it's kind of a big camp kitsch, big deal that I remember watching in the 70s. To be honest, I don't think it was such a gay LGBTQ owned thing until later on. I think once it became more obviously ironic, then I think it became something that community decided was, you know, it's not just theirs, but that they take a particular interest in. And that's important for what we are discussing, which is that Ollie Alexander, who is the British entry this year and who is a gay man and an actor and very talented, he has come under pressure this week, this last couple of weeks, to withdraw from the competition. And specifically, an organisation called Queers for Palestine tried to get Ollie Alexander to withdraw, and he said no, in fact.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons why they have contacted him is because he's spoken quite openly about the war in Israel and Gaza earlier on, and they wanted him really to put his support behind that further by effectively pulling out of Eurovision.
Okay, so that's all really interesting. And I think it brings up the whole issue of boycotts, of soft power, of the value of trying to force a country whose actions you don't approve of to withdraw from anything it's involved with, even if it's things that don't seem directly involved in any way with the conflict, like a song competition. But before we do that, can I just run through Israel's history of the competition? Because one thing that I think a lot of people might be thinking is, why is Israel in the competition at all when it's a European competition? And that is quite confusing.
And this comes up every year, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So I think this will be really helpful, actually, for me to understand as well. Why are all these non-European countries in the Eurovision Song Contest?
Well, there are quite a few. Australia is in it. I believe a lot of other Middle Eastern countries are eligible for it, but quite a few of them have refused to be in it over many years because of Israel's inclusion. The reason is, which is a silly reason, is that it's actually organised by the EBU, the European Broadcasting Union. And the European Broadcasting Union, because it transmits programmes all over the world, wants to include countries from all over the world, I think essentially for economic reasons, and therefore it basically extends the invitation far and wide. Israel were first entered in Eurovision in 1973. Obviously, that was when it was dominated by ABBA, but they did win in 1978 when their first win was with a song called Abba Nibi, that's Abba Nibi, performed by Izar Cohen and the Alphabetta, who I think I may have gone to Jewish youth groups with when I was younger.
Is that true?
No, it just sounds like Izar Cohen sounds to me like someone I knew in my Jewish youth group. And then quite importantly for what we're going to go on to talk about, which is about, you know, LGBTQ rights and everything, the first openly trans singer to win the Eurovision Song Contest was Dana International in 1998, who was also Israeli. And also they won it in 2018 with someone called Netta. And that's interesting as well, because I think there's just no way in the world that they can win it this year or possibly for a while, given what's happening in the world. So but it's interesting that they could win it as recently as 2018.
And Eurovision has always been political, hasn't it, David? Because there's always concerns about who votes for who.
Yes.
And whether they're actually voting for friendship or whether they're actually voting for songs. I remember that moment when countries just don't get a single vote and it feels really, really awful and political.
Yeah, well, I think we didn't get any votes for quite a long time after Brexit, where the main bulk of Europe just hated us. And it's well known that Turkey always votes for Greece and the Scandinavian countries always vote for each other.
I think the other thing that's been quite political, particularly about this year's Eurovision, is that in 2022, Russia, who also takes part in Eurovision, was banned from participating because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And so a lot of the arguments that have been made this year have been, well, the EBU, which runs the event, as you've said, if they couldn't allow Russia to participate, then why are they allowing Israel to participate? And there's been accusations of double standards.
Yes. I mean, you know, many Jews would not see an equivalence, or many pro-Israel supporters, I guess, would not see an equivalence between the actions of Russia and the actions of Israel, given that Ukraine did not attack Russia before Russia invaded Ukraine. But to be honest with you, I'm surprised there hasn't been more attempts by the EBU possibly to just blanketly ban various countries that might be involved in controversial conflicts, given that they're always saying, I should say this, they're always saying, we don't want politics to be involved at all. So something which I haven't mentioned, I'm not sure you know this, the original song, which was called October Rain, they had to change the lyrics because it was thought by the EBU to refer to October the 7th. Who knows whether it does? It had to change lines like no more air to breathe and there is no me anymore. I'm still wet from this October rain. It's now called Hurricane because presumably that rhymes with October rain.
And in the end, the president of Israel had to intervene and sort out the lyrics.
Yes. What an extraordinary idea that the president had to intervene. The idea that Rishi Sunak would get hold of the lyrics of Ollie Alexander's song in case that was considered to be too political and sort them out. That seems unlikely to me. What I wanted to talk about was this notion of pink washing, which, in case anyone doesn't know what that is, it's the idea that, I mean, it's specifically about LGBTQ rights, but it could also refer to, you know, sporting activities or cultural activities, where a country that might be in various ways considered a pariah puts forward something about their culture that is admirable and is then accused of weaponizing that in order to distract or indeed justify its actions elsewhere. So in the case of pink washing, what tends to happen when Israel is held up by pro-Israeli people as being the only country in the Middle East that has anything like a positive liberal attitude towards LGBTQ rights, that is something of a haven for LGBTQ people in the area, that they are instantly accused of pink washing, which means you're only promoting this about yourself in order to justify terrible behaviour elsewhere. Let me know what you think about that. I have an opinion about it, but I want to know what you think about it.
I think for me, well, it's really interesting because the term itself was popularized by Sarah Schulman, who is from the LGBTQ community and is Jewish. And she wrote about this in a New York Times op-ed. And she defined pinkwashing within the Israeli context as a strategy. And in a nutshell, what she was basically saying is it's to make Israel look like the good guys in the Western world, to say, look, we're great on gay rights, so therefore you can kind of ignore all the other stuff that you think we do, which might be considered not to be as in line with human rights frameworks.
Well, that's what it is. I was interested in what you think, because what I think is that notion is correct insofar as some people will be doing that. It is not correct insofar as it implies a sort of devious superstructure of the way things happen that doesn't really exist. It's a conspiratorial mindset. So it will not be the case that however gay rights have happened in Israel, which by the way involves quite a long history. The first gay bar in Tel Aviv was opened in 1968. Legislation was introduced in 1993 that allows gay, lesbian and bisexuals to serve openly in the military. The first pride parade happened in 1993. None of this will be happening because, you know, Israel is trying to weaponize gay rights to improve its image internationally. It will be happening because there is a strong and powerful and coherent gay and lesbian community in Israel and trans community, which is thankfully able to live live proudly, as Pride suggests, within Israel's borders. Now, that doesn't mean that once that has happened, that there won't be people saying, you know, oh, this makes Israel sort of a marvellous place in a way that is designed to rebut accusations. That does happen. I should probably say that queers for Palestine are often accused of a kind of oxymoron, or however you want to put it, of like, I believe the right-wing press have said that's like, you know, chickens for KFC, because in Palestine, as in other areas of the Middle East, homosexuality is illegal and punishable by, well, punishable by, in Palestine, I believe, by imprisonment and sometimes death, and certainly in other places in the Middle East, that is the case. I don't particularly agree with that joke, because I think that the fact is that there's no reason why a community might not want to stand for something that doesn't necessarily immediately impact itself, if you see what I mean.
I agree with you. I think the development of gay communities and how they started to become much more vocal and public in Israel was a natural phenomenon. But I think when it comes to the issue of the state then starting to promote this and looking at ways in which it can effectively talk about it in a much more open way is, and this is what, again, what Sarah Shulman says, she says it's quite a deliberate strategy, this concept of pinkwashing, to conceal the continuing violations of Palestinian human rights behind this image of modernity signified by Israeli gay life. But I want to take a minute just to talk about the history of LGBT rights in that region. So interestingly, it was in the 1860s when the Ottoman Empire decriminalized homosexuality when it ruled that region. And the criminalization of homosexuality was reintroduced in 1936 as part of the British Mandate of Palestine. And subsequently, again, interestingly, during the Jordan period, when it included the West Bank, in 1951, they decriminalized homosexuality. And that's interesting because it wasn't until 1967, some kind of 16 years later, that the UK partially decriminalized homosexuality. And in Israel, it was 1988 before homosexuality was formally decriminalized. So actually, the history of this is really fascinating, because under Ottoman rule, when you would have expected this to be an Islamic rule, it was actually decriminalized in the mid-1800s. And under Jordan, again, you know, under a Muslim state, it was decriminalized before it was decriminalized in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, there are nuances in it. I mean, the truth is that male same-sex activity is illegal and punishable by imprisonment in Kuwait, Egypt, Oman and Syria, punishable by death in Iran, Saudi Arabia, Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. In Yemen and the Gaza Strip, the punishment can differ between death and imprisonment depending on the act committed. Definitely, it's been different throughout history, and this is my point in a way. We say often on this podcast that both things are true, and I would say it is true that Israel is a haven for gay people in the Middle East. In fact, it includes, you know, a gay man called Ahmad Abu Maria was beheaded by homophobes in Hebron a few years ago, and he was trying to seek asylum in Israel at the time. The attack may have been to do with that as much as to do with his sexuality. But it can be true that it's a haven for the Middle East, and true that the Israeli government and some propagandists there try and use that fact to say, therefore, we are the only liberal democracy in the Middle East, which somehow justifies that the way that we behave on the West Bank and Gaza Strip, it doesn't. That's where I think the problem comes. But it doesn't mean that the LGBTQ rights as they exist in Israel aren't a thing that is positive about the country. I think both things are true.
I agree with you. There is no doubt that Israel's support of LGBT communities, including in legislation, far exceeds anything else in the region. And that's actually logged very independently by the United Nations. So there's a whole chart of all the countries in the region. And by far, it stands head and shoulders above the others on LGBT rights. I mean, it's still got some way to go because it doesn't recognize equal marriage in legislation. And that's one of the things that has been talked about. But what's interesting is a couple of things, I think, which I want to come back on. First of all, I think gay rights do exist for Israelis. They don't exist for Palestinians. And I'll tell you why I say that. Because if you are a Palestinian in occupied territory, occupied by Israel, and you say that I am a threat where I am living, can I come and live in Israel? You will not be granted asylum as a gay man or a lesbian woman because Israel doesn't recognize your rights. Secondly, it's well documented that, unfortunately, the military intelligence in Israel, it's a unit called Unit 8 8200, which actually is really celebratory about gay rights. It's also used, and this is again reported, it's in the public domain, blackmail when it comes to Palestinian people who are LGBTQ, because they sense that those people who are gay may not be sharing this information with their family and immediate friend circle. And therefore, they think they are ripe pickings, really, for using them for intelligence against the Palestinians, and therefore ripe for blackmail. So the use of sexual orientation as a, is defined by them as a weak point, inverted commas, is something which shows that their support for LGBT communities, unfortunately, seems to stop at the wall.
Okay, so I'm going to contradict that. A few years ago, the Israeli gay rights group, who are called Aguda, estimated that around 2,000 LGBT people from Palestine live in Tel Aviv at the moment. So clearly it is the case that asylum is granted. I'm sure that if any kind of military or intelligence objective can be garnered from, I'm sure the Israeli state will use it. But I don't think it's the case that asylum is never granted. Otherwise, those 2,000 people would not be living in Tel Aviv.
We'll have to fact check this, because my understanding is that they're not eligible for asylum in Israel.
So we've just checked it, and apparently gay Palestinians who might have been frightened for their lives and their safety in the West Bank and Gaza, a lot of them have fled to Israel, but in fact they were only granted full asylum in 2022, allowing them to work properly. Before that, a lot of them were not that secure in Israel. So it continues to be complex.
I think for me, I always kind of come back to, what does this feel like in real life? And one of the things that I did in preparation for this podcast was speak to somebody who works quite closely with Al-Quds, which is the Palestinian LGBT movement. And I think in the recent war in Gaza, it's been really quite emotional to see what people are posting on there, where they are gay, but they're also talking about their general human rights and the impact of the war on them. And if you take, for example, there's a rule, isn't there, that about 3% of any community at any one time is likely to be LGBTQ, then, you know, if you think about the number of people who've been killed in the last 6 months, 3% of those 30 odd thousand people in Gaza are likely to have been from the LGBTQ community as well. So I think they, the Palestinian gay community, are saying, look at our rights in the whole.
I've seen that said a few times, that at the end of the day, and it's completely true, of course, that, you know, it's slightly angels on a pin, the whole conversation about LGBTQ rights in Israel versus the lack of it in Palestine, when at the end of the day, many people are being killed. That's essentially what you're saying there, and that's true. But I do think that within the way the left and progressive react, there's an interesting thing that happens, which is the sort of total dismissal of Israel having a liberal attitude towards gay people, or indeed Israel being a liberal democracy at all, is just totally dismissed as propaganda. Almost as if, I think, it makes them more annoyed in a way. It starts to become a sort of relativist thing, which is, you know, this is just Israel saying that it's Western, and that in a way is more of a reason to condemn Israel, because there it is, a colonialist Western state in the middle of the Middle East with its, you know, obsession with things like gay rights, right? So I think it backfires against Israel, but I think that people should be able to separate it. People should be able to separate that essentially Israel is pretty positive for gay people. It is also weaponized by the state of Israel. That doesn't mean that some gay people aren't safe in Israel, that they might be elsewhere.
Yeah, and that's true. Gay Israeli citizens are definitely safer there than anywhere else in the region. But it kind of goes back to the, I suppose, the issue that we were talking about, which is Eurovision and this concept of boycotting. And there's been a lot of discussion, particularly in Parliament, around the issue of boycott, divestment and sanction, and particularly what is called the BDS movement. And I wanted to give a little bit, a quick explainer really, about the BDS movement. So this was a movement that was launched in July of 2005. By about 170 Palestinian organizations. They were made up of all sorts of people, trade unions, NGOs, medical associations, teachers, writers, farmers. And actually, interestingly, it was not a religious movement, or importantly, even an Arab movement, because it included Jewish organizations and includes now the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and included Christian organizations and includes Christian churches. And the context in which it was set up was that it was the year anniversary of the International Court of Justice's ruling that Israel's separation barrier, the wall, was illegal and that Israel had to dismantle it forthwith. And the reason why this movement came about was because there was a sense that they were about 10 years on from the Oslo Accords, and it felt like the end to the occupation was not in sight, that settlements were increasing, and that the talk of the two states was simply a cover for inaction. So that was the background and the context. And its aims, interestingly, were threefold. One, to end the occupation in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, and the Syrian Golan Heights. Secondly, to recognize the fundamental rights of Arab Palestinian Israeli citizens to full equality. And they talked about various discrimination that still occurred. And thirdly, to protect the rights of Palestinian refugees to return as stipulated in the United Nations Resolution 194.
I mean, there's a lot more to say about it. So BDS is very interesting, especially for sort of liberal Jews, I think, because some Jews actually support BDS. They support it in the same way they might have supported with South Africa, which is obviously the precedent of how movements across the world to boycott a country that they feel is behaving particularly badly will eventually put enough pressure on it to make it change its ways. Some other Jews are very against it because there's a history of boycotting of Jews that the Nazis, of course, began a lot of their persecution by boycotting Jewish shops. There is another thing which I think is very important, which is I think a lot of liberal Jews, and Jonathan Friedland actually wrote an article about this. Jonathan Friedland, who is a journalist and quite an interesting voice for Jews in general, said something which I think would be true of a lot of Jews, which is that they don't agree with BDS, but they very much disagree with government attempts, which is what is happening at the moment, to not allow BDS to exist, to not allow specific councils and others to be involved in funding BDS. Is that right? And because that's what the anti-BDS bill is it not? The anti-BDS bill is the Tory government saying, you'll have to help me here, Saida, you're part of the Tory government. Not the government, but you're part of the Tory party.
You're not part of the government.
We know that.
I'm hanging on by
a thread. This podcast is making it worse.
I'm hanging on by nails.
Yeah. But to explain something, which is that idea, which you have just outlined, which is that, you know, various forms of boycott, including companies, specific companies, which include many companies, actually, including Ben & Jerry's and SodaStream, that have got plants and factories in Israel, are publicized as you shouldn't buy from these companies, right? And that's part of BDS. So what is the law? So the law that the Tories are trying to put out, how does that work in terms of that movement?
Yeah, so there are two parts to it. I mean, the BDS movement is quite specific about who you should and shouldn't boycott. And most of the businesses that ordinary people in Britain are boycotting at the moment are probably not even on the list. They're really quite specific things. And one of the things that people forget is that most of these businesses are franchised, which means the people who own Starbucks in, for example, you know, Jordan are not the same as maybe the people who own it in Saudi Arabia or the people who own it in the US. But it's almost a sense of, right, we're going to go after the whole company and it doesn't matter who owns the franchise and where it is.
Yes, I think that we see quite a lot of that on social media. You see some quite strange forms of activism that are kind of involved with the notion of boycotting. So McDonald's, someone let some Palestinian flag coloured rats into one outlet of McDonald's. I mean, I'm a big fan of McPlants, I should say. So I was quite pleased not to be in a McDonald's having a McPlant at the time. Seems that like a very Baroque thing to do. How long does it take to paint a whole troop of rats three different colours? That must take a while, I would have thought.
But how do you paint them when they're moving around?
Yeah.
How do you paint rats? I mean, I mean, it's a weird thing to do, isn't it? Anyway, that's probably another podcast.
That probably is another podcast where we do that.
So what's interesting is that there's been, over time, a pushback against the BDS movement. And in fact, there was a formal meeting convened back in 2014 by Netanyahu, and he talked about the various approaches that Israel should be taking to push back against the BDS movement. So it's like a counter-BDS movement. And one of them was trying to get states around the world to adopt anti-BDS legislation. And in the United States, over 30 pieces of legislation have been adopted, which is anti-BDS laws. But in the United Kingdom, we've never done it up to now. And the piece of legislation that's been introduced is called, innocuously, the Economic Activity of Public Bodies, brackets, overseas matters, close brackets, bill. And it's been right. introduced into the House of Commons. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't know it from what it's saying. And it's been introduced by Michael Gove, who, you know, we know has a certain take on the world. And it's now currently in the House of Lords. And this legislation is quite concerning because what it seeks to do is single out Israel as the one country that we can't apply boycotts to or sanctions to or divestment to. It kind of carves out a special space for Israel. Now, there are others who would argue, well, Israel is treated separately in a special way and in a much harsher way than other parts of the world. So therefore, they need their own special piece of legislation which protects them in that specific way. So it kind of went through the House of Commons without much debate, typical House of Commons, but it's now in the House of Lords, and there is a detailed debate going on with people saying, well, you can't really put universities in this category. You can't really put that particular public body. Is it public bodies or is it public funding? Is it private institutions that are involved with public bodies? It's really complicated.
Right. Okay. And you've spoken out about it already in the House of Lords, have you?
Yeah, because I think one of the things that I said was that I do agree with colleagues who say that Israel should not be held to a higher standard than any other country. But we can't also say that it enjoys impunity in ways that other countries don't. Mm. So it should be subject to the same rules and standards to which we hold the rest of the world, and no higher and no lower.
Okay, so I'm just going to tell you some of the arguments I've heard about BDS. I mean, there is the general argument that it's considered anti-Semitic by those who always go there, and there is a history of boycotts, as I've already said. But there are other arguments. You slightly skated over this, but the founders of BDS, Omar Barghouti, for example, he said, we oppose a Jewish state in any part of Palestine. No Palestinian, a rational Palestinian, not a sellout Palestinian. That's a very interesting phrase. Would ever accept a Jewish state in Palestine. So it is the case that the founders of BDS and other people around BDS do not follow a two-state solution, and therefore it would be part of their rationale that BDS is a weapon to completely lose the fact of a Jewish state in Palestine, which, by the way, I mean, as a non-Zionist, is not always, I think, like an incredibly destructive idea. It can be, if it involves just the killing of people who live there. For some people, it's no, we have to have a secular state there. That's the only way to sort this out. I'm not sure that is, who knows? I don't know enough about Omar Barghouti to know. But he's on the extreme end of thinking about the Middle East. That should be clear.
I mean, I agree with you. And I think one of the things that I made clear is why I made clear when I was speaking in the House of Lords, that just to put on the record that, you know, there are some things, basic principles, that we can all agree with, whatever our position is on the anti-BDS bill. And that was about the recognition of Israel as a state, the recognition of Palestine as a state, the 67 borders, that settlements are illegal, and all of that kind of stuff, which basically meant that you ended up with two states, you know, an Israel and a Palestine. And I said that any movement that doesn't agree to that basic premise is not a movement that I can support. But what I don't think is the answer is to introduce one, I think, a quite restrictive freedom of speech and freedom of expression legislation through what is this anti-BDS legislation, because it's had serious consequences, David.
I'm just going to tell you the other main thing, the main reason that I've read as to why some people think BDS is not a good idea, and that's less to do with the politics and more to do with the workability of it. I read a piece written by a Palestinian called Bassam Eid, who said there is no connection between the tactics and objectives of the BDS movement and the on-the-ground realities of the Middle East. That wouldn't be right now, I think, but under sort of normal circumstances, Israelis do go to the West Bank to do business, and Palestinians buy and trade with Israel. And he says, this is a quote from him, if you ask Palestinians what they want, they'll tell you they want jobs, secure education and health, and the people who are failing them in this regard are Fatah in the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza. Now, there is some truth, probably, certainly not right at the moment, but there's some truth in the notion that trade, it's always been the case, actually, in kind of capitalist societies, that trade is a good way of easing conflict, right? The history of the Western world is basically people laying down their arms because they think there's money to be made in trading rather than fighting with their neighbours. That hasn't worked at the present moment, but it might work in a different scenario than we have right at the moment, in which case, would BDS be the right thing to do?
Yeah. So where I agree with you is that, you know, if you take, for example, what the BDS movement sees a huge success, the SodaStream case, it wasn't a huge success. The factory moved out of the West Bank where it was employing a lot of Palestinians, and it moved into southern Israel where it now employs mainly Israelis. So it actually had a detrimental impact on real Palestinian lives. I suppose where I disagree with you is that in the House of Lords, when this debate was happening, I heard really powerfully from people like Peter Hain, Lord Hain, and Paul Batang, Lord Batang, who were part of the anti-apartheid movement during the issues in South Africa. And they spoke so powerfully about how that movement had a real impact on what eventually led to a political resolution in South Africa. And Nelson Mandela has referred to that often, where he said local authorities, because of the decisions that they took in the United Kingdom, even though the national government was in quite a bad place supporting actually the apartheid government, but actually the decisions taken by local authorities and ordinary individuals who were part of this boycott movement, including issues around sports and business and others, had a real impact.
No, I'm aware that that is the precedent. I'm aware that, along with many other things politically that happened in South Africa, that was one of the reasons that led to the end of apartheid. At some point, we are going to have to, and we're not going to do it today, deal with the word apartheid and how true it is as a reflection of what's happening in Israel. True, by which I mean specifically how much it relates to what happened in South Africa.
Well, three terms that people keep asking us to discuss is: one is apartheid, second is occupation, and third is genocide. And I do think at some point we're probably going to have to deep dive into discussing those, just not today.
We are. Yeah, you've triggered all our listeners by saying those three words. But yes, we're not going to do it today because we haven't got time, because they all involve their own separate conversation. But I think, you know, the vast majority of liberal Jews would in fact be very, very keen on any kind of political and economic movement that would lead to the, you know, the far right Netanyahu government changing some of its tactics. I think that that's partly why, you know, very few Jews, I think, are pro the Tories trying to crush the idea of it completely in what seems like quite a confused way. I think it should not come from a position of this is how we dismantle the Jewish state, because that's just, above anything, that's not, just not going to work. If the BDS does have in its roots, we want to dismantle the Jewish state, I think that will just lead to a bad reaction from the Jewish community and a bad reaction from those people, the many liberal Jews in Israel, who might want to find a way of coexisting with the Palestinians. And that might involve, you know, various forms of supporting boycotts that seem to support the Netanyahu government.
I agree with you, because I think what we have to find, you know, after we've seen what happened on the 7th of October, the one thing we can all agree on is that we have to find non-violent resistance movements. You know, how do we get the Palestinians to resist occupation? Well, it's not the way that it was done on the 7th of October. It's not violent means. So we have to find non-violent means, and BDS, not the BDS movement, but boycott, divestment and sanction have clearly got to be part of that package of things that allow people to say, look, this is my way of protesting and trying to bring about an end to the occupation. But what I think is fascinating is the strong Jewish voices against this anti-BDS bill, including Jewish youth organizations such as the Union of Jewish Students and Jewish human rights groups. And, you know, of course, people like Jonathan Friedland, who wrote really strongly about this when it was going through the House of Commons, because he thinks it's a bill that's an attempt by, sadly, my party to pose as the, inverted commas, I quote, Jews' best friends after the angst of the Corbyn years. And it's meant as some kind of a gift. And he says we should not accept it. It's not just wrong in principle. It spells big trouble.
Well, we are in agreement. But speaking as a, the problem always with that notion is that it's so easily corrupted as an idea anyway. Like, Jews do not want gifts, political gifts, in that way anyway, but it's so easy for people to then say, you know, what is being offered as a gift will then be interpreted as, in fact, Jews in control. There'll be a particular kind of Zionists in control. There'll be a sense that this bill and any other bill will be not a sort of weird, that weird idea, which I think is a good way of putting it, of a gift for trying to get the Jewish community on side, but in fact, Jews working behind the scenes in order to create a network of laws that somehow uphold the state of Israel. And, you know, you see that all the time, particularly online, this idea that anything that favours the state of Israel is the secret work of secret Jews.
Again, it's people speaking for Jews and about Jews, which is what this podcast tries to stamp back against and say, no, we need to speak for ourselves.
Actually, on that note, shall we move on from boycotts to the next subject? I mean, we've sort of covered.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It, yeah. I think. On that note, obviously, we also want Muslims to speak for themselves and about how they feel about stuff going on in the news. And something that was pretty awful that was in the news recently was that the Taliban, who, of course, are in control of Afghanistan, have decided to reintroduce stoning as the punishment for women found to have committed adultery. And I read about that and I was thinking about you as I read it, because the leader of the Taliban, who is talking about this, just claims God as the reason for it. Claims that, I think he says something like, Western people who are upset about this, they may feel that because they are democratic and liberal, but actually they are working in the service of Satan, whereas he and the Taliban are working in the service of God. So there's a straightforward claim that this is Islam. You know, they are being good Muslims by doing this. And I just wonder how that makes you feel.
It makes me so angry, David. It makes me so angry, not just this, but everything that the Taliban have been doing. So this announcement by Mullah Hibatullah Akhundzada, who's the Taliban's supreme leader, he announced it in a voice message. There's all sorts of rumours, actually, interestingly, about him, because there's some talk that he might have been killed in 2019 and that these voice messages are not actually from him, because he's not been seen in public for a number of years. And it wouldn't be unusual for a leader of the Taliban to be dead and still pretend to be alive, because that's what the last leader of the Taliban did, Mullah Omar, where he died and for 2 years they kept pretending he was still alive. But I mean, aside from all the kind of crazy way in which they run the government, this makes me so angry for a number of reasons. One, because it is the exercise of violence and power over women, which for me, you know, is something that I've fought against all my life. And secondly, because they do so in the name of my faith. And they basically hide behind the faith as a way of effectively exercising control, state control, through criminal legislation as a way of subjugating and controlling women. And this has interestingly been done throughout history. And if they try and relate this back to religious texts, I mean, I always say you go back to any religious text, you know, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Quran, you can always find things which 2,000 years on, decontextualized, can be interpreted in all sorts of ways, even more so because most of the interpreting has been done by men. But interestingly, there was nowhere in the Quran is there any reference to stoning being an appropriate punishment for adultery. Interestingly, it's mentioned in the Old Testament in Leviticus, but it's not mentioned in the Quran. They try instead to refer to kind of teachings or stories that came many, many years later. And for me, this is, I don't want to hog the conversation because
I'm listening to you.
And I can feel myself angry. I can feel myself angry, David, as I'm speaking about it. You know, I was so reluctant about going into Afghanistan in 2001. And I said, we need to think long and hard, having had previous Anglo-Afghan wars, about what it is we're trying to achieve and how we're going to achieve it when we get there. And yet in 2021, I was also reluctant about us pulling out. And I remember during 2010 to 14, when we actually were having the discussion about the drawdown of our troops from Afghanistan, I remember speaking to my colleagues around the cabinet table and saying, you know, you were so quick to go in and now you're so quick to come out. And when we went in, one of the reasons that we gave were women's rights. So what are we thinking about now in terms of women's rights as we withdraw and leave them to the Taliban? And a colleague said to me, well, we can't just keep our troops there forever. You know, protecting women's rights is not a reason for us to deploy. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but it was a reason given back in 2001, amongst others, that we were, which was that one of the, it was amongst one of a number of reasons that were given when we went into Afghanistan in 2001.
Can I just stop you there? Sorry. You know, the specific politics of and hypocrisy of how we went into and came out of Afghanistan is really interesting. But I just wanted to stay for a minute in the wider focus of religion and misogyny, because you mentioned Leviticus, and of course it is the case that almost all the Abrahamic religions, possibly all religion, but certainly the Abrahamic religions, about which I know a bit more, are misogynistic in and of themselves. That, you know, they believe in a patriarchal God, and the way that the ideas about them trickle down to actual life on the ground almost always involves women being owned in one way or another by men. So I think all religion includes all sorts of misogyny. In Orthodox Judaism, there's a lot. And in fact, there's been a lot of dramas, interestingly, on Netflix about the subjugation of women within Orthodox Judaism. But there are things that are very similar. Jewish women have to wear shaitels, which is a type of wig so that their actual hair can't be seen because that's considered too inflammatory. That would equate, I presume, to the various types of coverings that exist in Islam. And I wanted to ask you something, which is, and it's very hard for me to talk about this because I am neither an Orthodox Jew, nor a Muslim, nor a woman. But what you do get, what I read a lot, is that some of those impositions, some of those strictures on women, including the shaitels, certainly including the hijab, are seen by some women as empowering. And obviously, I can see how they might be, but it would still be the case that they go back to male ownership of women, do they not? So I wondered how you felt about that.
I think there are two separate things here. There's one, what rights do these religions give to women? And secondly, what choices do these religions give to women? And, you know, here's a bit of breaking news for you, David. So I have spent 99.9% of my life dressed as you normally see me, you know, in without a head covering. But there have been moments in my life when I have worn both a hijab, which is a head covering only, and a niqab, which is a face covering. But for me, what it comes down to is not what women wear, is whether they have a choice in what they wear. And if by choice they want to be covered from head to toe, so be it. If by choice they don't want to be covered from head to toe, so be it. So I don't ever make judgments about what women wear, but I always will fight for their right to choose what to wear.
I guess what I think is that was very interesting, your thing about choice. My worry is that choice is a complicated thing, particularly in repressive societies, including repressive societies like in Stamford Hill, right? Including repressive societies that might just exist in localized areas. I personally, as an atheist, feel that religion tends to be repressive. It can be a source of great joy, and it can be a source of great culture, obviously, but also it definitely has this thing, this patriarchal tendency to make women the site of purity. Right.
So interestingly, I spent some time with the Orthodox Jewish community in Stamford Hill and went to see some of the initiatives that they run there, and have spent time talking to women who've chosen to live this life. And they would argue, and again, I don't want to speak on behalf of Orthodox Jewish women, but from the conversations that I've had, they would argue that actually they are empowered and that they are making choices about their life. And they've made choices about the importance of family and children and community, and that overrides their need to have huge careers or an amazing education, because they feel that they have an amazing education through the way in which they are educated, including religious education.
Yeah.
But for me, it comes back to choice, you see, because...
But I think choice is a complicated thing when you've been brought up, essentially, which those communities have, and, you know, conservative Muslim communities would as well, many types of different religious communities. It's not clear what choice they offer. I mean, speaking from what I know about Orthodox Jewish communities, they are very closed, right? They don't really allow anyone, including the men, to really experience what it might be like outside, to really experience freedom. And freedom, by the way, you're absolutely right, particularly for women under capitalism, involves all sorts of different types of what you might call enslavement, including enslavement to a beauty ideal, enslavement to an idea of a domestic ideal. There are many, many ways in which misogyny, which is always the most powerful force in almost any culture can be imposed on non-religious societies. The only thing I guess I would say is, again, it's the both things can be true thing, is, you know, those women that you've spoken to have made a choice, and maybe it's a free choice, and maybe it feels empowering. At the same time, they have to go to a mikveh in order to purify themselves whilst menstruating, and there are all sorts of other strictures involving, you know, that being dirty in some way. They do have to wear a shaitel because their hair is somehow inflammatory to men, and all of this treats them as if they are owned by men. And there are ways in which women can turn that round, because women are able to do that because women are continually made second-class citizens, and they're able to somehow, throughout history, make that into a life which is amazing. But I don't think we should forget that that still is men doing that, is what I think. As a feminist, I've said it. There, it's out there. I've said it.
Yeah, I mean, but interestingly, you see, in Islam, a lot of women would argue that they own their men. And I'll tell you why, because there are let me give you two or three interesting examples. I mean, first of all, the Married Women's Property Act came into law in the United Kingdom in the late 1800s. The Married Women's Property Act, or a version of it, was actually part of Islam 1400 years ago. My property is mine. It doesn't belong to my husband. He doesn't have any rights over it, which also, by the way, includes my income. So if I go out and I earn a living, that money is mine. By the way, my husband's income, when he goes out and earns a living, is also mine. I have a right to what is his. He does not have a right to what is mine. I mean, we have rights to all sorts of things, like rights to have a nanny, rights to have a wet nurse. If I come from a home where my parents had a cleaner or maybe home help, then when I get married, I am entitled in my marriage contract to demand that he provide me with a cleaner and home help, because that's what I'm used to and he knows what he's signing up for. So for me, I mean, you know, my husband often jokes about it. He says, you know, you seem to know all the rules, don't you, when it suits you. That I think there are all sorts of things which give me a huge sense of, yeah, power's probably the word, a huge sense of power, which for me is not actually based on Western ideals of feminism, but is also rooted in what I think are Islamic principles. You know, one of the arguments that I used to use is, let not Muslim men today deny you the rights that your faith gave you 1400 years ago. Islam isn't the thing that takes away women's rights. Muslim men are often the things that take away women's rights.
But they do use Islam. That's the point. I'm happy because I don't know anything.
Of course they do.
I don't know anything
religion
about
is always
it.
Used.
Yes, religion is always used to do that, and it's been used by Christianity over many centuries to do that. Just to say, I am now reading this because I don't know about it, but just to give an overview of that, Pakistan is currently deliberating over whether or not Islam allows domestic violence. That's Pakistan's Council of Islamic Ideology is arguing that Islam does give men the right to lightly beat wives, marry girls as young as nine years of age. They decided that it might be un-Islamic to penalise violence against women. What I'm saying is that it's only really in Muslim countries, there might be some others but I don't know, in Muslim countries where such things, scriptural reasons for this type of misogyny, might be enshrined in law. Right, that's the issue. The issue is that there are states that are using scripture, and no doubt corrupting scripture, to impose misogyny in law in a way that would not be true of most modern, you know, Western states, however much lots of types of misogyny still exist within those cultures.
Let me just give you a bit of a reality check, David. There are states, Western states, called the United States of America, which actually uses scriptures to control women's body by telling them they cannot have abortions and whether or not they can practice reproductive rights. Mm. So men, unfortunately, will always use religious texts, and it's always men and it's always religious texts, as a way of exercising power over women, over their bodies, over their choices, over their education. Let's take an example. The Taliban not allowing girls to go to school. The very first verse in the Quran that everybody accepts was revealed is a verse which starts with Iqra bismi rabbikal ladhi khalaq, which in Arabic basically translates as learn in the name of the Lord. It basically says, go out and get an education. And there's stories which say, even if that means traveling as far as China, because China was considered to be a really far away place, and that's where you should go to seek knowledge. That is the basic religious scripture. It doesn't say, oh, men, go seek knowledge, or oh, women, go seek knowledge. It says, oh, people, go seek knowledge. And yet the Taliban will try and rely upon scripture to say, you girls are not allowed to go to school. There's some really interesting work that's been done by female scholars and female academics. And one of the big missing pieces has been in more recent times, although it did exist historically, was women interpreting faith. And if you leave a religious text to be interpreted by men, of course they're going to interpret it in a way which suits them most of the time. And I think there is a huge need for women, you know, women rabbis, women bishops, women scholars within Islam, who actually interpret their faith in the spirit in which it was intended. Because so often when these religions first came to the fore, they came into societies which treated women far worse. I mean, if you look at Islam, for example, the way in which Arab society operated before these detailed scriptures were laid out about how to treat women, how to marry women, how to provide for women. There was a real abuse of using women, sexually abusing women, not taking responsibility for the children that come of those relationships. So I think it's really important for us to talk about context, time, space, interpretation, and also push back on men who use religion to suit their own purposes.
Yeah, well, I agree with all that. I guess what I think is that, I mean, interestingly, this article that I've got most of my information about religion and misogyny in Muslim countries was written by a writer and social commentator in Pakistan called Kunwar Kuldani Shahid. And he raises something at the end, which I guess I think is what I'm interested in to some extent, because I think you're right about women. And I think that the control of the narrative by men in those countries, obviously you're right, also in America about abortion, not completely in control because, you know, Joe Biden is president and he believes abortion should be legal, but you're right, in certain states it isn't, and scripture is used all the time to back that up. But his point is that there is, from the progressive left, some of who will be listening to this podcast, something of moral relativism about this. Because the progressive left are very, very worried about seeming somehow, you know, like the white countries being patronizing or critical of countries that are non-white. And so therefore there is a resistance to condemning very, very regressive attitudes to women. Whereas I feel that you're right, those attitudes need to be condemned. There needs to be less of a fear around from sort of white liberals to condemning it, but saying what is needed is that the women in this country need to be respected and they need to write their own version, as it were, rather than having imposed on them by men. And I guess I think that that sometimes seems very difficult because men seem so in control in these places.
And that's why diversity and multiculturalism is so wonderful, because I actually think much of the new thinking around Islam or many of these religions isn't going to come from the East. It's actually going to come from the West. Some of the most fabulous, amazing kind of scholars in Islam at the moment actually come from Western countries. And that, I think, shows that there is a universality to the way in which this faith can be interpreted. Interestingly, when I was in the Foreign Office, David, there were certain things that the Foreign Office would say to me were off limits in certain countries, including things like blasphemy and women's rights. And I took not a blind bit of notice of that advice, because I thought that the whole point of being able to challenge and question from a position not of colonialism or, you know, white supremacy, but actually from a position of, I have skin in the game in so many different identities and parts of the world. This is my faith as much as it's anybody else's, and I'm not going to let them have complete control over how it's seen, enabled us to do some phenomenal work in places like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and Afghanistan. And it's why it breaks my heart when we withdrew from Afghanistan, because those women that I sat with, those politicians who made up nearly 30% of the country, now none, those women who made up the civil service, those women that we encouraged to become judges and law enforcers, who actually imprisoned members of the Taliban, who are now on the run fearing for their life, we failed them.
One thing though, a positive thing that you said there, which I think is very interesting and kind of moving, is the notion that multiculturalism, which is an unbelievably embattled idea at the moment, with lots of people now just saying that multiculturalism has failed in Britain and all that, which is, I think, completely wrong. It's in a tense situation at the moment, but it has certainly not failed. I had not really thought about that from what you've just said, which is that, you know, my point just a minute ago was that sort of white liberals are very frightened of criticising other cultures, particularly brown cultures, particularly Muslim cultures, because they don't want to be out of their lane and they don't want to seem, you know, like Western supremacists, basically. But of course, one thing that the West has done, even though it's struggling with it at the moment, is create multicultural societies. And therefore, there are people like you. There's not enough people like you, but there are people like you who have a voice, who have imbibed different ideas while holding on to your own identity, but different ideas about democracy and feminism and all the rest of it that allow for a speaking out about these things that is not Western supremacist, because your heritage is from these countries. You have a way of speaking about it, that a freedom to speak about it, to challenge it, that I think a lot of people feel nervous about. But there aren't enough people like you.
I think more recently, as part of the culture wars and this pushback against multiculturalism, it almost becoming a dirty word, we've forgotten how powerful we are as a nation because we are made up of so much difference, and actually how much good we can do in the world because we can do it so confidently without having to feel like we have to be hesitant when we explore what our values are. And those values are universal, and we can make the case around the world, as I did when I was in the Foreign Office and as I continue to do. And it also allows us to have conversations like you and I are having now about these really tough subjects, which, you know, can be quite simplistic as part of a kind of a populist political space. But actually, when you dig down and discuss them in detail, we start to realise that our difference is actually our strength, not a weakness.
So once again, we've gone there. We've taken the light-hearted route, which was to start off by talking about Eurovision. And, you know, that involved references to Dana International and pop music. But through that, we got into the tough issue of boycotts. And then I think possibly the even tougher one of misogyny in Islam. But we've come out the other side, as we often do, sort of metaphorically hugging.
What has surprised you about today's conversation, David?
I'll be honest with you. Sometimes it's stuff that's staring you in the face. And when you said that thing just now about how multiculturalism, which is so embattled, that's never struck me as an advantage of multiculturalism, that you might be able to, as it were, globally change things because you have more of a license to speak about that than people who, you know, can trace their roots back, which I certainly can't, to, you know, Queen Anne. Actually, I'm going to tell you a word. I'm going to tell you a Jewish word. So it was very trying today, right? Both technically, in terms of Ramadan and you being hungry, and in terms of what we were talking about. And yet we didn't have, this is the word, a broigus. And broigus, which is a key word for us, actually, is basically the Yiddish word for big row. And so far, I think we've got close to it, but we've avoided having a broigus so far. The day we do have a broigus could be the end of this podcast, of course, because broigus tends to be in a big row where Jews don't speak to each other for years. But yeah, that's the word I'd like to teach you today.
Broigus. I don't know if there is an equivalent of it in Urdu. You know, there could be jagra, which is a fight. It's probably what my kids call. So there's an interesting Indian TV channel called Star Plus, which has these crazy dramas on it, which are always over the top. So whenever there's a big issue that comes up in one of the families, my kids will always say, "Oh, is it Star Plus drama level?" So yeah, Star Plus drama level is probably my kind of response to it.
Okay, I can say that quite easily. I don't have to wrap my mouth around Star Plus drama level. I can say that. But yes, a broigus is a Star Plus drama level, and I'd like to see a whole musical on Star Plus called Broigus! We're open for listeners' questions. If you want to send us any questions, we will. I know we haven't, but we will be doing a question and answer episode. So keep sending them in. The email address is podcast@instinctproductions.com.
Hold up.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.